And what the progressives sometimes do is say, okay, you guys want respect, we'll see what we can do. But then the homeless people, you know, get really upset and say, wait a second, I don't want to see what you can do. I mean, you know, I want to be able to, you know, put a tap somewhere right now. You know, I need a place to, like, take a leak or whatever. And they start putting pressure on the progressives, and the progressives take that opportunity to go, no. You know, they have to take a lot of shit from the conservatives, and they got to do it. They got to toe the line a lot of times on a lot of issues that they want to. But here, the homeless people start, you know, getting out on their case. They can say, no, I take a lot of shit from people, but not from these guys. And they can say to the conservatives, see, these homeless people are demanding these things, and I'm taking the high line. I'm not a total pushover. And that way, they feel they garnish enough votes to stay in power to make some other changes that are more politically expedient. They think they may have a chance to do it, and the homeless issue gets put on the back burner and the back burner and the back burner.
Yeah, that actually has been a criticism of some of the tactics that some of us have used by other homeless activists who say that it's really important to build coalitions with progressive politicians and to encourage and persuade them that it's best for them to take on the homeless issue, take on the issue of homeless rights, that they're going to be attacked as anti-law and order no matter what they do, so why not, you know, get at least a part of the more liberal part of the constituency and take on the homeless rights issue. In fact, Tom Noddy, the man you mentioned, has been successful in some respects at numerous times in the early 80s, getting successful positive responses from some of the city council members. By the early 80s, the Santa Cruz City Council had become progressive dominated, as it has remained ever since. I use the word progressive loosely. We may have a phone call here. Hold on. Yes, you've reached...
You've reached Free Radio Santa Cruz, 89.3.
Hey there. Yeah, if you could have more callers if you answered the phone. Anyway,
thank you.
I know you're busy, though.
No, I think you're quite right.
Okay.
This is my second day on the phone. Sorry, folks.
Okay. Hey, it's great to hear you on the radio. I do have some concerns, though, because I own a small business here in town, and I also have friends who've, like, tried to run businesses on the mall and whatever. And, you know, I think people should have the right to camp out or panhandle if they want to. But I think what happens with a lot of these store owners, they get kind of frustrated because a lot of their clients feel more comfortable going to the nice 41st mall where they're not going to have to see people who are poor or, you know, listen to deadhead music or whatever. And, you know, a lot of middle-class people, they feel like they got the wolves nipping at their heels, and they feel like this stuff affects their business, and I don't think they have any real fundamental difficulties with people panhandling or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, what about those folks? You know, it'd be interesting to hear somebody who'd started a small business is now out on the street who'd maybe seen it from both perspectives.
You are a small business person yourself.
Yeah.
Well, then perhaps you're the man we should interview in our next show.
Well,
we interview you right now.
Yeah, I don't own a small retail business, but, you know, I've worked in them and other things like that.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, not in this town, but I used to have to get up every morning at my brother-in-law's shop and help the winos off the steps and prop them up in the alley and then sweep up the broken glass and hose off the vomit and then step in wino shit all the time.
What city was this?
This was a small town in Arizona.
Right.
Why, I have a question. Why is it that you just didn't throw the winos out or call the police? Why is it, you know, that you actually helped to prop them up in an alley rather than have them arrested?
Well, because they're people, and you know, a lot of times I would call the cops. Actually, the cops are pretty good in that town. They take them to the drunk tank and, you know, let them dry out and that sort of thing.
Would you have called the police if the police were very repressive and would have mistreated the...
Probably not.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
Well, maybe that's what we need to do in this town. Maybe the cops, like, you know, being... bullies around is like maybe that's the problem. You know, if we get the police to treat the homeless with some kind of respect, then maybe that's the clincher right there.
Well, I agree with you on that point because, I mean, I do know a small business owner here who saw a, you know, a homeless person get in an altercation with somebody else who was just a bully. And, I mean, there was blood flowing. They had called the cops, and cops drove right by, looked right at the victim, and just went on by. And I found in this town, for the most part, the cops are a bunch of namby-pambies. They don't go after real criminals. They go after easy targets. They go after kids on skateboards. They go after homeless people. As soon as the sun goes down and it's dark, they don't deal with the real criminals. I was jumped by a gang of people, my girlfriend and I was, and I had to chase this person for like 45 minutes or so before I finally caught them in an alley and was able to get a cop there. There is a rumor going around amongst the small business people that they ignore crimes down there in the downtown area because they want the pressure to get strong enough to where people will just be fed up with street people and whatever else so they can do a clean
sweep. I have a comment on that.
This is a rumor, of course.
Oh, no, of course.
That's about right.
Here's George Solis.
This thing about picking easier targets is the same thing with politicians. It seems like if you go after crimes committed by poor people, these minor crimes, this is the easier thing to do than to chase a rapist or a mugger. And your arrest statistics stay just as high, or your political standing stays just as high. So you're absolutely right on picking easier targets.
Yeah, and the rumor that you mentioned, that report has reached me from numerous other sources. For example, in the spring of 1994, last year, I was given a report that police had been laying off any kind of enforcement in order to build up pressure for Neil Coonerty's and Scott Kennedy's anti-homeless downtown ordinances. You know, the laws make it illegal to sit down on the sidewalk. And so
right.
This also pertains to Proposition 187. They didn't go after any of the farmers or the employers. They went after the so-called illegal aliens because they were the easier target and they're less apt to contribute to a political campaign.
But I know that this goes on. This town has an image of as a liberal progressive town. It's a bunch of BS. It's like a small town. It's the big operators still run everything behind the scenes, and the citizenry are usually distracted by minor things.
Right.
They continue to do what they want to do.
And the question is, how do we reclaim the town? I guess I'm encouraging people to organize, whether it be around a free radio station like this at 89.3 FM, 427-3772, or whether it be organizations. And do you have any thoughts on how to strike back against this kind of small-town conservatism and transform it?
I'm not sure I have any small thoughts on that.
No small thoughts. You've got great thoughts.
I wonder what happens, though, because you will find people that are small, middle-class people, and unless you've run your own business, you have no idea how much work is involved and how much stress and whatever else. And
the answer to your original question was, what do you do with real, genuine problems of drunks and abusive panhandlers and that sort of thing?
Yeah, or it may even be a deadhead playing a radio out front that you have to hear over and over and over and over.
Do you have any ideas on that, George?
And it does tend to drive customers away and that sort of stuff, and it becomes frustrating.
Yeah,
because
definitely.
They take it out on the nearest target, too, which happens to be that person out front. But, you know, they have to deal with the IRS and the city and their greedy landlord and on and on and on. A lot of these people are caught, too.
Well, how about our panel going into that and answering on the air? Is that okay?
Yeah, that would be great. Just if there could be some sort of respectful way to work it out, because I know a lot of small business owners down there, and they're, you know, not anti-poor people, but they feel like they're caught a lot of times, and there's not enough respect on both sides. And I have nothing wrong. I have no problems with people panhandling. I think it should be an American right. You should be able to go up and ask somebody for money, and a person should have a right to say, no, I'm not going to give you any money.
If United Way can do it, why can't the ordinary person on the street?
Right. And, you know, but sometimes it gets to be problems where people aren't responsible enough themselves, where they don't.
Right, let's
nice
talk about that.
And place to take a crap, instead they do it in the alley or whatever.
If you find another dry spell on our phone call, please call us back and we'll pick up that conversation.
Okay.
And we'll try to answer your question on the air.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
I wanted to say one thing about businesses. I am interested in starting up some very small-scale, ecological type of businesses. So if any homeless people have any ideas, on that type of thing, could you please call 423-HUFF and let me know, and I might be able to help fund start you up.
Getting back to the question posed by the caller, George, you have any thoughts on that? What are the proper ways of dealing with
it? Well, as I said before about the American dream, this country, this world is in trouble right now. It's a depressive time, and I feel like we're on a sinking ship, and what they're going to jettison first is that lighter weight cargo, what they consider the less valuable cargo, and that is the poor people, the homeless people, and the merchants would have to blame the homeless people, who's next after you get rid of all of that? I mean, you're going to have that lower poverty, unemployed level. Businesses downsize. And when they downsize, that just isn't a word. It means people are laid off. People, in turn, lose their homes. They become what we think of as a noun, which really isn't, the homeless. It's a state, a temporary state of being. And so we have to understand that our ship is in trouble. Our ship of state is in trouble, and we're jettisoning real human lives, citizens of our community who have fallen on hard times. If it tends to bug us, if people are crapping in an alley, well, that's against the law. But it's not against the law to be poor. And it seems like the only crime in this country is poverty.
Well, in terms of the specifics of what do you do? If I mean, I'm not really in the business of giving merchants advice in that sense. I'm not really that's a particular field. But I it is a real problem. And if I were to do that, I would propose things like mediation, and I would also say that there are existing laws that allow you to deal with real crimes of violence, and real crimes of assault, and real crimes of harassment. And I would have had very little objection to downtown ordinances being passed last year that talked about harassment. What I object to is when merchants simply want to start blaming a class of people for their business problems. They're not talking primarily about abusive panhandling. They're not talking about people being drunk, because if they were, they could deal with those problems under existing law. No. What they're talking about is being able to give the police power to eliminate collections of deadheads on the streets.
Unsightly
poor people. Unsightly people, exactly. But in answer to your question, what do you tell? There are merchants who feel that these laws are wrong. In fact, there were some merchants who came out against them, very few, because it was a very kind of a juggernaut that happened last year. The city council just zipped through these laws. But what was proposed instead? Mediation is an idea. If you have someone who will go in between these groups and bring to the sidewalks and the people on the sidewalks the concerns of merchants in a reasonable and respectful way. And if it's being done to some extent by peer groups, for example, the street performers code was a thing that successfully took hold in the early 80s, rather than a whole series of restrictive laws against street performing, although we now have some of those restrictive laws under the downtown ordinances. But that code specified, it wasn't a hard and fast thing, but it was sort of an understanding between performers, like musicians and jugglers and clowns, and people engaging in any kind of public activity like that, that if you were there for an hour, and if a merchant was really getting bugged, he would come out and tell you, and you would try to move along. It wasn't a legal contract. You could stay if you wanted. You weren't going to be, you know, that wasn't it. You know, but there was an understanding that developed, and that has developed over the last decade, where you kind of, it's more of a give and take, a loose situation. Because I think even merchants at the bottom would prefer to be human beings, and the less we stereotype these situations, and the more we deal with each other as unique individuals, and the more resources we devote to really mediating between people, understanding our different worlds, the more chances we have of resolving these situations not merely peacefully but productively, which I think is the point. That the streets of downtown Santa Cruz are a draw because of their diversity, because of the incredible amount of life and difference and color that's on them. Carmel is not a draw because of its streets. Carmel is a draw because it's got glitzy shops that German tourists love to go to. That's one way of drawing people into town. I mean, you know, if I were interested in making money in that way, I suppose I'd open a shop in Carmel, but I don't. You know, I'm And I don't think Santa Cruz wants to do that. The Santa Cruz downtown is not simply a merchant center. And unfortunately, that has been the pressure in the last decade to turn it into more and more sterile merchant center. Now, I was given a kind of an emergency bulletin about 15 minutes ago, which I'm going to pass on to you. It's not related to homeless issues, but that issue is Mumia Abu-Jamal. You know, you folks know about Amia, about the state of Pennsylvania. He's planning to kill this former Black Panther. He's an award-winning journalist, a political prisoner on death row, Mumia Abu-Jamal. And if you want information about this guy, it's at 335-3268. You can give a call. But the word has just come in. Pennsylvania governor has signed his death warrant. I repeat, the Pennsylvania governor has signed the death warrant for Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Sounds like a good time for a riot to me.
I pay no attention to the little man in the background. There will be a demonstration in Santa Cruz at the town clock at 2 o'clock on the Saturday after the death warrant for Mumia is signed. So that would be tomorrow, Saturday at 2 o'clock at the town clock. You can call Refuse and Resist for information about that. That's 335-3268. Again, I repeat, Mumia Abu-Jamal, his death warrant has just been signed by the governor of Pennsylvania. There will presumably be a demonstration tomorrow, 2 o'clock at the town clock on Saturday. For more information, call 335-3268. George, you want to say something else?
Well, I just have to go, but I just want to say, especially to people like the merchant who called, we're in a bad economic time. Bear with it. If you have any problems with people, step outside your shop when you get a chance. Sit down with someone. Explain the situation to them. Maybe you could give them some money to go over to somebody else's shop and sit in front of their store. However you do it, these people are not the homeless. They are citizens of your community who happen not to have houses. Their homes are Santa Cruz. They have a home.
Thank you, George. And that was George Solis, a Sonoma County activist. George, you're going to get in touch with me later, I hope. Where are you going to be? Okay. Oh, are you going to bookshop Santa Cruz? I'm barred from that. Okay, so George is off, and...
When I said that thing about riot, I was really thinking of Pennsylvania more than Santa Cruz.
I think he's calling for a riot in Pennsylvania. Nah, probably just calling for people to stand up and speak out against all this, as am I. Well, anyway, I know what I'm calling for, whatever Brian's calling for, he calls for. Brian wants me to talk about the Bag Ladies Revolt.
When was that? Jane M. Lehrer.
We've actually talked about the Bag Ladies Revolt numerous times on the station, but I could sum it up for Brian, also for Linda, if she's listening and she knows about it better than I do.
Well, what Linda said was it was her, her best memory. That was what Linda the Master said just recently in the car.
We're talking about a group called Bag Ladies Revolt, which. It was an impromptu group of women who got together in the fall of 1988 to challenge, actually to mock, a sort of a humorous, again, as a small humorous group of bag ladies. They dressed up as bag ladies and they kind of paraded on behind Mayor Marty Wormhout's Christmas Day parade around Thanksgiving. And apparently Marty's car broke down. She was in an antique car and her car broke down, embarrassing her, particularly because the Bag Ladies Revolt, the three or four ladies at the end of the parade were giving out flyers talking about the city's unresponsiveness to homeless concerns, about the fact that people were being beaten both by private individuals and by police, and also that the camping ban itself, with the sleeping ban, which bars sleeping outside after 11 o'clock at night until 8:30 in the morning, was being enforced rather viciously by police in spite of ongoing demonstrations by homeless people, in spite of endless bi-weekly requests by the homeless to have the issue reconsidered by city council. Bag Ladies Revolt is a group that's done a number of kind of comedic actions like that. Bag Ladies Revolt took over the Heiner House in 1992. The Heiner House, you may remember, was a beautiful Victorian house that was on the corner of, it's either Lincoln and Cedar. It's the other end of City Hall near Mission Street, which is now a police department parking lot. And the Heiner House had been earthquake damaged, and it stood empty for 2 or 3 years. And the Bag Ladies Revolt, headed by Linda Edwards, Jane Immler, and Linda LeMaster, who that year ran for city council, and supported by myself, John Hamilton, Terry Messman, other people in what we called the Baggy Boys Auxiliary, took over the Heiner House in the sense that we set up sleeping bags in it, and we asked the city to open it up to homeless families. And we were arrested, and they dragged us into court on trespass charges, and eventually they dropped all the charges. I threatened to use jury nullification as a tactic in court, that is to say, the practice of telling the jury that they have the right to disobey, to say that even if we're violating the law, that we find you not guilty. Any jury has that right. Jury can not only make a decision about the narrow facts in a case, they can also decide that there's a fundamental injustice being done, regardless of what the judge says, and they cannot be questioned for that decision in any other place.
And that's a legal right, but if a lawyer tries to say that, he'll be disbarred or something, but as a defendant, you can say that.
That's true. So Bag Ladies Revolt is about that, and it's about... It's
what about the parade? What was the parade?
We talked about the parade. I told you, Marty. It
was a parade. What was the parade about? What was the parade for, generally? Was it a 4th of July parade or what?
No, no. We talked about that already, Brian.
Today?
We just talked about it. It was the Thanksgiving Christmas parade in 1988.
Okay, and what happened? People dressed up as bag ladies, right?
Okay, yeah, that's right, Brian. They were dressed up as I just said. I just went through this.
We've been living together a little bit lately. I mean, not sexually, but in the same...
Thank you, Brian.
And this is a really small room here. Anyway, what Linda Edwards said about it was that actions that had spontaneity with audacity were the best memories that she had. I'm sorry if I misquoted you, Linda Edwards, but that's what Linda
said. Right. Now, Brian, you're going to have your whole show to talk about Linda, and I think you will do that proudly. I'm going to turn to other topics, and we're going to discuss... I got a whole bag full of clippings here, and I'm going to invite people to call in at 427-3772. And Brian's going to keep an eye on the phone and screen all you nasty callers, hopefully encourage all you callers to give a call here. And I'm going to start running through some other things. What have I got here?
Youth curfew.
Let's begin with the youth curfew. There have been a couple of clippings in the paper recently, the most important of which, and I think the most positive of which, is the Metro Santa Cruz's long story on...
Charlie Tuttle just came
in. It's called Outside the Law. Outside the Law is a two-page story by Metro Santa Cruz, which really gives a very interesting... of course, they agree with me that youth curfews suck and are bad, but they actually present a lot of information in their article.
One more thing. I'm not going to say anything after this, but somebody made a comment about German tourists a little bit. I don't think German tourists are that any different.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian. Brian isn't really disturbed. He's just full of passion at this moment. Anyway, the article in this week's Metro Santa Cruz talks about kids, curfews, and the cops. The law that's being considered in the county is a draft of the law that combines Capitola's law with what the Criminal Justice Council, which is a local version of the State Justice Council, considers favorable elements of San Jose's teen curfew. San Jose has had a teen curfew recently, and they've had a lot of... they've been putting out a lot of positive publicity on how good their curfew is. And this article takes up the positive statements made about the San Jose curfew and examines them in some detail. And I refer you to this article in this week's Metro Santa Cruz. But there are a couple things I wanted to bring up about it. According to this, teenagers, since the county curfew is passed, would no longer be able to simply hang around a timeless rite of youth and almost the only thing teenagers can do on a Friday or Saturday night, nor could they embark on an aimless stroll, a right enjoyed by all other citizens. UCSC senior Kevin Peterson, 22, volunteers for the American Civil Liberties Union, And he doesn't know how they can justify curfew laws. Punishing someone based on age doesn't seem so different than doing it based on race. He's surprised that more of these laws haven't been challenged. In fact, the first such curfew laws were applied to slaves, and they happened during those slave-holding times in our history. Then there were curfew laws which were applied against Japanese Americans during the Second World War, when the government seized the homes and businesses of Japanese Americans and locked them up in camps. Juvenile curfews date back, according to this article. Hang on there, folks.
No,
hang on, that's our mic. Just a second. they date back to the turn of the century in this article by Michael Mechanic. I want to give Michael a plug here for this Metro Santa Cruz article. They date back to the turn of the century when a widely cited 1957 study found that half of all American cities with more than 100,000 residents had juvenile curfew laws on the books. Now, it's interesting that in Oakland, after debating a youth curfew for years, Oakland city officials scrapped the idea a few weeks ago, citing cost as the number one concern, and the San Francisco Police Commission concluded in 1990 that a curfew could not be fairly enforced. Although state and federal Supreme Appeals courts have declared adult curfews unconstitutional except in temporary emergencies, there have been limitations that allow them to. They said that children's rights can be upheld when the government shows a compelling interest. I beg your pardon, children's rights can be bypassed or sidelined or limited if the government can show a, quote, compelling interest in the children's welfare. Steve McDonald, legal intern for the ACLU's Northern California chapter, gives a somewhat unequivocal answer. He says, curfews have been around forever, and there's not one study that shows they're effective. San Jose's study is the first to try and say they are, and it's very flawed, even if you take their numbers at face value. Now, the San Jose study, what does it say? Well, in January, the San Jose Police Department, according to this article by Mike Mechanic in the Metro News, released an evaluation of that city's teen curfew, which then applied to kids under 17 and was extended in March to include 17-year-olds. Police tallied incidents involving juvenile suspects or victims over a 17-week period and compared the numbers with the same period during the previous year when the curfew wasn't in effect. Okay? They found that the overall number of violent, quote, incidents where a juvenile had been identified as an offender increased 27% overall from the previous year, but only increased 9% during curfew hours. So that's a drop during curfew hours. Incidents involving property crimes, which had dropped 2% from the previous year, dropped most during curfew hours. The evaluation also states the number of juvenile victims of crimes increased overall, but actually decreased during curfew hours. So the claim is that, well, it's crime is dropping, victimization is dropping during curfew hours. The department concluded that the law was effective in reducing juvenile violence and victimization and recommended to be extended to include 17-year-olds. That's the police department's claim. But the ACLU man, Steve McDonald, legal intern for the ACLU's Northern California chapter, has this response. He claims there are serious flaws and questionable conclusions. First, the police define an incident as one where a juvenile is merely identified as a suspect or victim, a designation often based on hearsay, where they were identified and not, let's say, seen or booked or something like that, rather than reliable statistics such as a juvenile arrest or conviction records. That's one criticism he has. Another one is the study covers a short time period. The actual number of incidents are too small to be statistically meaningful. The evaluation, for instance, cites 10% fewer incidents involving juvenile victims of violence, but that represents only 6 incidents over 17 weeks, a change that could be attributed to practically anything, including randomness. And then finally, the study fails to consider whether the incidents took place indoors or out, which makes the numbers even less meaningful, especially since most juvenile victimization, according to McDonald, takes place indoors. He continues, even if the numbers were meaningful and the change was attributable to the curfew, McDonald says the law still isn't effective. He says the law, police already have numerous tools in the books to stop and detain suspect youths, and adds that approximately 80% of juvenile crime, and this is the figure that impressed me, 80% of juvenile crime takes place during non-curfew hours. Most of it, according to another article I was reading and may be able to dredge up here, between 3 and 6 in the afternoon. So I guess you've locked everybody up between 3 and 6, you'd cut down crime too. During the study period, police stopped roughly 4,300 young people, but only 1 in 4 was violating curfew. Of these 1,082, only 21 were arrested for anything other than a curfew violation. So that means 900 and over 1,000 people were stopped for curfew violations, and only 20 of those had an additional real charge. So the overwhelming majority of the activity was innocent, and the curfew had created its own infractions. McDonald noted that 61% of those detained were Hispanic, 61%, 22% were white, and 7% were black, raising questions about discriminatory enforcement or unfair impact on certain ethnic groups. And then cost is another major issue. The study cites just 4 fewer criminal incidents of any type involving suspected teen offenders or victims per week. So you've got 4 fewer incidents, and what's the cost? Between $8,000 and $1 million per year. Even if you take the numbers at face value, I say it's not effective, says McDonald. So that's, you're paying $800,000 to $1 million per year for 4 fewer incidents. And incidents, again, is a vague term. It doesn't necessarily mean any kind of criminal behavior, just an incident, which is even a curfew violation. So studies have shown that the biggest reduction in crime came from increased recreation, is what McDonald says. Cities should follow Oakland's lead and sink money into recreational activities and education. I'd like to know your opinion on curfews, and the number to call is 427-3772. And we're talking about youth curfews here, and I just read you an article from the Metro Santa Cruz, quoted from it. I'd like to know, what's your view on this proposed curfew for young people? If you're a young person, call up. If you're an old geezer, call up. If you're somewhere in the middle, call up. Hey, you know, whatever your age, give us a call. And the number to call is 427-3772, and I'll try to keep an eye on the phone line, make sure that if you call, I will actually answer the phone. So give us a call, let us know what you think of that issue, and we'll talk about it. And while we're waiting for those calls, I'm going to play us a little something from the Jolly Roger Comedy Troupe. And the Jolly Roger Comedy Troupe, as some of my regular listeners may know, is a group in Berkeley, a satirical comedy group, which deals with local Berkeley. It's very funny, and is it may be a little obscure to some of you, but I think you'll pick up on it. I hope we're not in the middle of one. If we are, bear with us. You'll catch some of the humor, and I'll be back with you shortly. You're on listening to Bathrobe Spears Broadsides on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 89.3. Please call in at 427-3772, and we'll be back with you shortly.
News for News focus today is on the latest GOP response to the needs of the poor, the New World Orphanage. Here at the New World Orphanage, disadvantaged children from all over the nation are removed from their neglectful, impoverished families and given happy group homes in a quasi-military school setting. The children are just sitting down to their dinner.
Hallowed English, who art in Congress, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done, here at the New World Orphanage, as it is in Congress.
Here is Morella Fiber to give us a tour of the New World Orphanage. Miss Fiber, whose picture is that up on the wall?
That's our founder and moral strength, Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, without whom these little children would still be living in their unhappy homes.
And just what is that you're serving today at the New World Orphanage?
Why, gruel, of course.
Gruel?
Yes, gruel is rather traditional fare here at the New World Orphanage.
Well, I assume this would be a better meal than they would otherwise be eating?
Well, these children had homes, of course, and they must have been eating something. But most of their mothers and fathers were unwed, you see. So even if the food here is rather plain, at least they're here eating it in a stable environment.
These children were taken away from their parents?
Well, you can hardly consider them qualified to be parents, although of course they are parents. Not only were many of them unmarried, almost none of them owned their own homes, and the neighborhoods they came from were often extremely unsatisfactory.
I see. And how often do they get to see their parents?
We have supervised visiting hours once a week, but we find that the New World Orphanage runs much more smoothly without the constant disruption of visitors.
This place reminds me of something.
Excuse me, miss?
Yes?
If you please, miss, could I have some more?
What?
If you please, miss, could I have some more?
I think the child is only asking for some more.
Security! Food. Security! Please remove this threat to the stability of the New World Orphanage at once!
Well...
There, that's better. You were saying?
Well, just how this place reminds me of something. Well, Miss Fiber, is there something a parent could do to qualify for the return of their child?
Well, once a parent has a stable environment to offer their offspring, we of course would consider an application for the return of their children. A stable environment consisting of adequate financial security and evidence of a moral atmosphere in the home. Republican registration doesn't hurt. And of course, a large contribution to the New World Orphanage can be helpful.
I see.
We of course insist that all unwed parents acquire a husband or wife before the transfer. And we have a service right here matching up unwed parents with suitable marital partners.
But what if some of the parents prefer to pick their own marital partners?
Well, frankly, we think the government has much better perspective on this, and we must insist on a quality arrangement for the sake of the needs of these dear, dear children.
Of course. And the fact that putting a child in a government-run orphanage is actually more expensive than welfare. How would you address the issue of expense?
We feel, of course, that making sure these youngsters have a stable environment is worth the expense, but we're planning to make some adjustments to help offset costs. Some of these little kiddies would, I'm sure, be happy to skip a few meals in order to help their government, and they certainly could be put to work making, say, license plates or other goods.
Now I know what this place reminds me of.
We're certain that with a few adjustments, the government can raise children more cheaply and efficiently than their parents ever could. Although corporate privatization of the orphanages is not out of the question, especially considering the angle of cheap labor, the need for these children for discipline.
Well, thank you, Miss Fiber, for showing us around Newt's New World Orphanage. We wish you and all your little charges the best.
We'll certainly do our best.
That was Miss Morella Fiber on behalf of the New World Orphanage here at National Corporate Radio. And now, back to you in the studio.
And you're listening to Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, Free Radio Santa Cruz, 89.3 FM. Call us at 427-3772, and you can get on the air and tell us what you think of what's going on, particularly around issues of youth curfew, around issues of homeless rights, around issues of police abuse. And again, I'm going to repeat the announcement I made earlier today. The word just reached me that Mumia Abu-Jamal, the political activist, former Black Panther, prize award-winning journalist, and political prisoner on death row, has been not only sentenced to death, his death warrant has been signed, and there will be a demonstration, if this poster reads true, tomorrow at 2 o'clock at the town clock. And that, to find out more information and to clarify whether I'm not just whistling Dixie here, you call 335-3268 and get the word from them. So, often on the show I read you from Julia Vinograd. She's a poet. I've got one of her older books from 1980 called Street Tenses with us here. She's a Berkeley street poet. And here's a couple of her poems to mellow out the two-hour program. People's Park. This is no man's land, and no man may profit from it. You enter at your own risk, because the animals inside are not tame. This is ours, whoever and whatever we are or aren't. We don't have to get along, organize, explain, or be tidy. It goes deeper and is much more simple. We don't own anything except what we stand up in. So this is a muscle we flex, a shared breath. This is our skin, with flowers tattooed on it. That's People's Park by Julia Vinaigrette from her book Street Tenses. And on the same subject, here's People's Park Power, her next poem. I shall not praise the whirlwind and curse the debris it leaves behind. Here are pictures. The time I took off my rings, put them in my purse so they wouldn't get in my way, and grabbed the pickaxe like a real worker while hoping my purse wouldn't get ripped off. Then wanting to rip it off myself. The startled look of drooping plants stuck in at all angles while asphalt comes off smoothly with natural rhythm and blisters. People singing mellow off-key songs around the fire that wouldn't start, enough wood, not enough paper, till someone added a copy of the U.S. Penal Code. Then it blazed like Hitler's ovens, like chaos, like keep your laws off my body buttons, and it was appropriate. Later there wasn't enough wood, and the visionary watchtower got burned up slowly against the cold. The stabbing that had no business happening when we were all feeling noble. There is no such thing as a spontaneous committee. Policemen got a police escort of dope dealers to leave the park in safety, but of course they came back. Veterans were more pleased with another war than with winning. Enforcers threw people out and called any space case they didn't like a snitch. Where did the idea come from that you had to be paid by the police to be obnoxious? Can't people be idiots on their own and for free? If there isn't something about it in the Constitution, there should be. Drunken fights between fighting drunks. The flag. The fire. Food. We were the Boston Tea Party in a hobo camp. A tribal feeling excludes people who don't understand because we don't understand. We only whirl in the whirlwind. We tore down a parking lot and put up anything but paradise. Who needs paradise? That's called People's Park Power, and Julia is speaking about the 1979 occasion when the University of California tried to again pave over People's Park in Berkeley right off Telegraph Avenue. And the response of the community in 1979 was to pull out the pickaxes, pull down the fences, and tear up the concrete and plant flowers again and plants. And similar situations are happening now in Berkeley. Similar attempts by the University of California to once again expand itself, to remove homeless and poor people from the South Side, to yuppify the situation and turn it into a little annex, another little part of their profit-making machine there. What they're trying to do now, according to activist Cornerstone Carol Denny in Berkeley, is they want to remove the free food services, remove the free clothing box, and apparently change the stage in People's Park. People's Park has been built and developed around the idea of user development. That is, the people who make changes in the park are the people who live there, who work there, who come in and who have developed the park over the past few decades. Not any large corporation like the university, not bureaucrats from the city. And a lot of people feel very strongly about it, and for that reason, people nonviolently resisted the decision of the university and the city to put in volleyball courts and sports courts in 1991, since that was an obvious attempt to destroy the park. It had nothing to do with real sports needs. It had to do with changing the whole environment of the park and turning it into an upper middle class area, in spite of the wishes of those who were using the park. So what the new plan is, according to Carol Denny, is, and according to apparently it's been published by university authorities, they want to, and the city council in Berkeley has actually supported this plan now. So there were some dissenters, but they voted, I think, with 6-2 with one abstention to support this plan to, in essence, get Food Not Bombs, the group that feeds free food every, I think it's almost every day in the park, to move, to try to get the food box, the free clothing box to move, and to change the stage, to redesign it. And activists are mobilizing to resist changes to the park that are not done through the people who are using the park, not user-developed changes. Because in the past, these changes have simply been a very subtle, thin subterfuge. They've just been a basis and an excuse for further privatizing spaces, denying them to poorer people. And I'll try to give you more on this as it happens. I don't have much information for you. I may have a call-in number in Berkeley to give you if you want more information around this issue. If I can work my way through this mass of papers to find the information. This may be it. Let's see here. Yeah. You can call the Long Hall if you're interested in getting more information around the issue of People's Park at 510-540-0754. That's the Long Hall in Berkeley at 510-540-0751. Or you can give me a call if you just have a local number you don't want to put through a long-distance call, 423-4833 or 423-HUFF. That's Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and I'll call you back. Again, I remind you, you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, which is a call-in station. I mean, you give us a call at 427-3772. Even if I haven't answered the phone in the past, I have glued my eye to the blinker on the phone here, and I'm going to be putting all my energies into making sure that you get on the air if you call in. So if anything I'm saying or anything that any of my guests have said has sparked any interest, please give me a call and let me know. Let me hear your point of view. I know my point of view. I want to hear some other points of view as well, and I'd like to hear how...
Hi, you're on the air with Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hi, Robert. It's Lighthouse Linda.
Lighthouse Linda. Oh, good. How you doing, Linda?
Okay. I can hear your radio today. Some days I can't.
Oh, that's positive.
I have an opinion, if not a point of view, about curfews.
Mm-hmm.
And this is my opinion. It seems to me that curfews are the kind of thing that are needed during a war, that kind of a national disaster, to protect people from enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And when we start using them on our own children, there's something terribly, terribly wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I have said to the electeds and others,